Professor Brad Hayes, Associate Professor of Political Science at Union College. He's an expert in the judiciary. When we last left, you were telling me and telling all of us that because they have now changed the so-called nuclear option, and now anybody, all they need to get judicial appointment through is half the votes, plus one. And therefore, you said a huge number of judicial posts have been left vacant because of the opposition to Obama in the Senate, among other things. Can we expect to see a Republican judiciary forever?
No, not forever. Just to contextualize what you said a little bit further, the Obama administration, in part because of the reform to the filibuster, was quite successful in getting their nominees onto the federal courts. So the district court level, the Court of Appeals, and then, of course, the Supreme Court, such that right now the ideological balance on the federal courts actually does tip in favor of Democratic nominees. So the ideological balance has shifted a little bit. That's particularly notable on the U.S. Courts of Appeal. For example, there's a Democratic majority on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, which is often considered kind of like the mini Supreme Court. It's probably the most important of the U.S. Courts of Appeal. That being said, though, like all things, right, these things are subject to change and change somewhat quickly. And we mentioned previously that there are a bunch of vacancies, and we can expect the president to have some measure of incoming President Trump, to have a good deal of success in filling those seats so long as he makes it a priority. One of the criticisms of the Obama administration early on in his presidency was that they seemed to be almost indifferent to filling judgeships. They were really slow to move. They didn't expend a lot of political capital on it. And many argued that that cost him in terms of the ways in which or the degree to which he could transform the federal judiciary ideologically. And given that there are about 100 vacancies here, that it is suggestive that they might have been able to do more. Now, again, like I said, the end of the filibuster for most federal judgeships clearly helped. But nevertheless, it is, it's still out there. And so Trump is going to have success. And of course, you know, the big one, of course, is the Supreme Court. And that has, you know, ideological effects that cascade downward because of the degree to which it sets precedent that lower courts then are expected to follow.
And what can we expect from Donald Trump and the Supreme Court?
So one of the things that Trump did that I appreciated as a citizen is that he released his list of potential Supreme Court nominations as a candidate. So he released a list of 21 names that he said he would draw from in making his selection for the United States Supreme Court. So in other words, you could kind of get a sense of what that.
And have you looked at the list?
I have looked at the list. It is, you know, conservatives will be very, very happy with that list. There are he draws fairly heavily from state Supreme Courts, which is a little bit unusual. We've seen the balance kind of go in favor of other federal judges that are kind of almost being promoted up to the Supreme Court, like Chief Justice Roberts. But there are also some prominent conservative federal judges on the list as well. And, you know, it's a list of people that are, you know, quite qualified for the most part. They are quite conservative, though. And so, I mean, no great surprise there. But I think Trump released that list initially to try to shore up his support with the religious right. As such, that list is going to be very appealing to social conservatives. And so we should expect that. I expect that a nomination to come very quickly in the Trump administration, I think within the first several weeks. In some ways, as a consequence, we're going to have, you know, the politics of a Supreme Court nominee early on in Trump's tenure, which then will very much put the ball in the Democrats' court in terms of the kinds of strategies that they want to employ.
What can they do?
Well, right as we discussed before, the filibuster is still in place. So Democratic votes at this point in time still matter. And that means that it matters. They can evaluate to see if this person is too far to the right, right? And I think they have a good deal of political capital in that regard, in the sense that while Trump wants to say that he had this, you know, huge electoral win, he didn't, right? And he loses the popular vote. The Electoral College win was certainly notable, but it was not a huge one. So to declare a mandate is going to be somewhat limited. So I think Democrats can feel empowered to resist, but yet that will very much be tempered by the threat of eliminating the filibuster for Supreme Court nominees, which is something that the Republican majority can do. So they're going to have to balance their resistance with the real ability to undercut that resistance by changing the structure of the resistance itself, meaning the filibuster.
It doesn't look good for the Democrats to do to the Republicans what the Republicans did to Obama in saying no to Merrick Garland and no, you can't have your appointee.
It doesn't look good. I mean, I think you could try to imagine the following kind of scenario. So, you know, Democrats would have to hope for the Trump administration to be a little bit slow in terms of making the nomination. And to be very, very conservative. So in that kind of a scenario, if you have an ideologue without perhaps the heightened qualifications of some of the current members of the court, Democrats might be able to sustain a filibuster to the point where the person essentially pulls out, right? And so then you have to start the process all over. And so you're pushing that then, I'll say, into the late fall and maybe into the winter. And at that point, you have a congressional election that is a year away. And you say, well, hey, we're only a year away. We're going to continue our resistance until at least we get this vote. And if Republicans win, then we can do the up or down vote. In other words, you cite the Merrick Garland precedent and you attempt to play it that way. I think those are very long odds for Democrats. I don't think that'll work. But I think if I am in the strategy room, that's my strategy.
Now that you mentioned the word strategy, let's talk Chuck Schumer, the United States Senator from New York, the senior senator. What about him? How much will his strategizing count?
Oh, it's going to count a lot. I mean, because one, you're going to have to ensure that the Democratic caucus is united. I mean, if you begin to have fracturing in the Democratic caucus in the Senate, then you're going to get past the filibuster, right? And there are, we talked about previously that the political terrain for Democrats in the Senate is pretty dicey, given that there are 10 Democratic senators facing re-election in states that voted for Trump. Well, you might then perceive it as in your best interest not to resist, but in fact to play ball. In some ways, that's going to probably cost you less than what
The other side of that is by then Trump may be so unpopular that anybody who puts up roadblocks is going to be popular.
That's a possibility too. But that suggests, right, the strategy of trying to delay. Right.
Yes.
You try to delay, allow things to play out, get closer and closer to that next election. And the more that Schumer can do to hold the Democrats together in the Senate, the stronger case you'll make for being able to do it.
It's always great to have Professor Brad Hayes, scholar in residence here at WAMC, with us and explaining some very complicated stuff. But I really liked what you had to say today, Brad. It makes great sense, and I appreciate your coming in.
It's always a pleasure, Alan. Thanks.